We're now going to continue our conversation about that race with our Week in Review panel. From the Boston Globe, we have Deputy Editorial Page Editor Dante Ramos. Hi, Dante.
Hi, how are you?
Good. And we are joined here in the studio by John Carroll, a professor at Boston University's College of Communication and the author of the Campaign Outsider blog. Hi, John.
Hey, Sasha.
And thanks to both of you for being willing to do this the day after Thanksgiving, which is a holiday for so many people. We're glad you're here working
no
with
problem.
Us.
No problem.
So, Dante, first to you. We interviewed Frank Adevinola, Catherine Clark's opponent, on Radio Boston last month. And we should generally say that he is, in general, considered a Tea Party candidate, although he doesn't quite sort of explicitly embrace that label. But there is a sense, it seems, that this race is in the bag for Catherine Clark, in part because of how different Frank Adevinola's political sort of focus is, given that this is Massachusetts. Dante, is that how you see it? How do you see this race coming down?
Nobody should be shocked to wake up the morning after that election and find out that Catherine Clark has won it. I think Adevinola hasn't really run a very high-profile campaign. He doesn't seem to have a lot of money behind him. His most recent campaign finance report suggested that he had raised about $100,000 this year, most of it being lent to the campaign apparently by himself. Clark's campaign has brought in $1.4 million, which speaks to obviously the Democratic bent of Massachusetts politics, but also a kind of organizational strength that Adevinola doesn't have. So, you know, the nightmare scenario for Democrats in Massachusetts is always the Scott Brown election. Mm. But in the weeks leading up to that, you could feel that there was something going on and Brown was gathering momentum. And that doesn't seem to be happening with Adevinola.
There's also been relatively little media focus on this race, as we said. And to give you a sense of what I mean by that, we have a piece of tape from November 20th. This is an appearance on Fox TV with host Maria Stefanos.
The Republican Frank Adevinola is here with us now in our Dedham studio. And we repeatedly extended an invite to the Democratic candidate. State Senator Catherine Clark was showing you an empty chair because that's where she would have sat if she was here, but she declined to be here today. We also asked for a statement from the Clark campaign. We have yet to receive one. So, Frank, I guess we turn our attention to you.
All right, so a little variation on the Clint Eastwood empty chair. But we did ask Catherine Clark during our interview about the lack of debates during this campaign. And she cited two things that she described as debates. One was a joint appearance that the two candidates made at Framingham's Temple Beth Am back in October. And then a joint appearance on New England Cable News scheduled for next Friday. Now, we should say that we're not clear whether the Temple Beth Am really was a formal debate. But in general, John Carroll, what's your take on Catherine Clark's press strategy here?
Well, first of all, if this were a Little League game, they would stop it. But I don't think you can invoke the mercy rule in a congressional election. But I think her strategy is to run the clock out. You know, Dante's right. There's no Scott Brown in this race. There's Frank Adevinola, and there are two independents, James Olenty and James Hall, who will presumably split the James vote. But he's entirely ignoring those two. When he calls for debates, he's calling for debates between himself and Catherine Clark, not including the independents. So I think Catherine Clark is, if you heard the interview, I mean, that was all Democratic boilerplate. And I think her goal is the Hippocratic Oath, you know, do no harm. And I think that that's what she's going to do until December 10th. She would have to work awfully hard to lose this race.
Dante, any other take on this other than laying low is the best thing she can do to ensure a win?
I don't know if laying low is exactly, I mean, you know, waking up in the morning and breathing air is probably the something that she can do to guarantee a win. It strikes me just as an observer of these things as a little disappointing, and it feels like whatever ground rules there might be that you at least owe your opponent a couple of high-profile debates. You know, perhaps it seems a little unsporting, but I agree with John. I don't think it really amounts to a whole lot in the end.
John, you just made a comment about much of the interview I had with her on her end being Democratic boilerplate. And the Globe, Dante, as we mentioned, had editorialized that she was open to the so-called grand bargain on big issues facing Washington. But as we heard, she pushed back on that. You know, she said Social Security is going to be sacrosanct. So can we expect, if Catherine Clark wins, that she'll be a backbencher, essentially?
John? I think that that she probably will try to fit in as best she can. I don't think she's going to be taking the lead on any kind of grand bargain. I don't think anybody in the House Democratic caucus is going to be able to do that. I think that you say things in campaigns that you may have excellent intentions, but then you get down to inside the Beltway and the whole world changes, and so people do as well.
I want to touch on casinos as well. This morning in the Globe, the Secretary of State, Bill Galvin, mentioned two proposals, one that would eliminate automatic increases in the gas tax, but the other one, relevant to casinos, would repeal the state's casino law. And that now has enough signatures to appear on the November 2012 ballot. That, of course, is the latest setback to legalize gambling in the state. We've had several towns reject plans to build casinos within their borders. The head of the State Gaming Commission is Steve Crosby, and here he is speaking on Tuesday.
I'm a little bit surprised that some of the communities where there's been a long time coming, like Palmer, where Mohegan Sun's been for a long time, and East Boston, where Suffolk Downs has been, I think all people were a little bit surprised that, that relationship has gone on for so long that if you had to guess, you would have guessed what happened. But this was all about, from the beginning, a high degree of local control. The legislature said if you don't want a casino, you don't have to have a casino. That doesn't mean there's no place for casinos. Nobody wants to live by a mall either. Nobody wants to live by Fenway Park either. But I don't want the Red Sox to leave town.
Now, Dante, first of all, we have to say, in terms of not wanting to live around Fenway Park, those are some of the priciest condos in the city right now, by the way. But is this, in general, this sort of shift we're seeing in casinos, is it classic not in my backyard, or has the state changed its mind about casinos? Is this an evolving thought among voters?
I think it's a combination of the two. Obviously, there is, in all sorts of development projects in Massachusetts, there is oftentimes the default position is no. People don't want something that's potentially disruptive. At the same time, when the casino legislation passed a couple of years ago, people basically took it as a given that it was something with majority support. And it does seem as though the passage of, or the fact that some communities are standing up to reject this is, you know, that there's a certain contagiousness to it where people think like, oh, we can actually vote these things down. Now, I would say also another issue here is that the state tried to do two somewhat incompatible things. One is bringing in casinos, you know, which is an industry that has its own warts. The other is that they really did set up a tough vetting process for the applicants, which includes this local vote. And those two things really don't sit all that well together. It turns out that when you scrutinize a lot of casino proposals, there are things in them, either business partners or aspects to the plans that people really don't like and are incompatible with the idea of making guaranteed money by bringing in casinos to begin with.
And of course, there was also that telling study within the past week or so, or a poll that said that while many people support casinos, they don't want them in their immediate community. So there's that factor. John, do you have any different take on this?
No, I think if I were a betting man, I would take some action that there's going to be no casino at all in eastern Massachusetts, because there are a number of stumbling blocks. One is that Wynn Resorts, which got approval in Revere, still has to get past the State Gaming Commission. And that's no easy task. Caesars Entertainment got bounced because of ties to the Russian mob. Well, there are reports that Wynn Resorts has ties to organized crime in China. So that's one thing. Another thing is there's no telling whether the vote in Revere is going to hold up or not. They voted for a casino that would be partly in East Boston, partly in Revere. And it's probably going to wind up in court to decide whether they have to have another referendum again. And then finally, the repeal the casino deal, ballot proposition. Attorney General Martha Coakley is challenging that in terms of being unconstitutional and saying you can't vote this out because these people have paid licensing fees. That one's going to wind up in court too, probably. So there are a whole lot of reasons why this may not come to pass, especially in the near future.
John and Dante, this whole conversation has me thinking back to one of the debates during the mayoral primary when all of the candidates were still in the race. And I remember Bill Walczak, you know, the one sort of anti-casino opponent, sounding like such a lone voice in the wilderness, saying, if I'm elected, I will repeal the law. And many of the other candidates seem to be thinking, Bill, get with the program. Casinos are coming. But here it looks like maybe they really won't be coming. Do you share Dante John's view that we may not have one, at least not in Eastern Mass?
I wouldn't. If I were a betting man, I probably wouldn't bet entirely against it. But I think the dynamic that John's describing is exactly right. What we thought was, after the passage of the law, was going to be a fairly straightforward, if controversial, decision process for the Gaming Commission has turned out to be something that has a bunch of unanticipated variables. There's the ballot question that John referenced, and the question of Indian casinos in southeastern Massachusetts showing some potential to disturb the process, and there's just a lot of questions that are circling about now that I don't think were part of the original discussion. And if it does come onto the ballot, there may be a lot of people who think, well, you know, this isn't something that really worked out all that well for Massachusetts, and, you know, maybe we should just end this discussion now.
All right, so a shifting of gears, I want to talk a little bit about the city of Lawrence, where just this past week, after the recount, it is confirmed that Daniel Rivera is now the mayor-elect. He's going to take over from William Lantigua, a mayor that there were such high hopes for, but he's really been dogged by a lot of corruption and patronage allegations throughout his tenure. I talked to Dan Rivera this week for All Things Considered on Wednesday, and he really talks about the city like a real estate agent. I mean, he's so excited about it. And I asked him, what's the key to turning around the city? Here's what he said.
Telling people how great of a place it is to come live.
That's simple.
I say it jokingly because, I mean, we have nowhere else to go up but up, and we understand we have a great opportunity in front of us. Our schools are turning around. Our property values are low, but it means it's a good entry point for young families. So you talk about this place as a really an upcoming city to live in if you want to live in a city environment.
Dante, given the many problems that Lawrence has, its schools in receivership, 50% high school dropout rate, many other problems, how persuasive do you see that sales pitch being?
The gateway cities, these are the mill communities, the former mill communities in Massachusetts that fell on hard times after World War II, all have a similar set of problems, meaning that, you know, they've had the situation where the schools start to decline and people start to move out. And, I mean, you have seen in bigger cities like Boston and Cambridge, there's been an urban revitalization. And if you think about it, there's no real reason to think that couldn't happen in a smaller city. And in a way, there are certain problems that should be easier to fix in a smaller city like Lawrence. Now,
what sort of things do you have in mind there? What might be easier?
Well, for example, the schools. And this is one thing that, I think you mentioned that the schools have been in receivership. Uh-huh. At the same time, they now have a receiver who's been able to extend the school day and put in new provisions for compensating or rewarding teachers according to their ability and their achievements rather than based on seniority, which some people don't like, but other people see as a sign of reinvention. And it's the kind of thing that a bigger city or a city that hasn't fallen quite as far wouldn't be able to put into place.
And I'm not going to say that this... We should note that receiver, Jeff Riley, was recently trumpeting some improvements they've seen in the schools, including, I think, one school that finally had some MCAS scores up with some of the better school districts. So they claim that they're seeing some improvement.
Right. And if that's something that becomes a building block for a broader revitalization of the city, I'm not going to say it would be an easy thing to do or is a slam dunk, but there are seeds of hope that exist. And I think Rivera seems to be able to set a better tone for that than Lantigua, who seemed to breed a lot of distrust among a lot of people.
One of the specific policy proposals of a sort that Rivera has said just this week is that he wants to institute random police checks at the borders of Lawrence and the communities that surround it to basically stop people from coming into Lawrence to just buy or sell drugs. And when I asked him how exactly that would work, and particularly the legals of it, this is what he said.
Well, I mean, at the beginning of every month, a lot of people's inspection stickers come up for review. So you just set it up so people have to come through, and you can do, again, this isn't going to be a police state. It's just a message that we need to send people, that if you're going to come and you're going to make Lawrence your drug mall, we're not going to have it.
Now, John, I pressed him on this because I said, you know, without warrant or cause, how do you really do this? Mm-hmm. And how do you know someone is in town for a drug buy? And he basically said he'll consult with his police chief. But he says the larger issue is, as he said, sending a message. Do you see this in some ways as a sort of populist rallying cry? We're not going to let people bring Lawrence down anymore?
Well, paging the ACLU, paging the Massachusetts ACLU, they're going to rush into this. I mean, it's an interesting idea. He also said he was going to go to the Andover town meeting and say, here are all the people from Andover that are coming into Lawrence to buy drugs.
Yeah, exactly.
Not sure that's going to happen either. I think that the idea of cracking down and making pronouncements about increasing public safety is a good thing. And one of the other aspects of this is the city of Lawrence, its finances are under state control as well as the schools. So as a former mayor had said, that leaves Daniel Rivera open to focus on public safety and jobs, which are two things that that are really difficult tasks to sort of get turned around in the right direction. So he's got the luxury of not having to worry about those two areas, really, on a day-to-day basis. So I think that the idea of being aggressive is good. Whether he's actually going to be able to implement these particular ideas I don't think is really the point. The point is that he's trying to deliver a message to the people of Lawrence and people around in other communities that Lawrence is no longer going to be the Lawrence that they thought it was. If I could add just one more thing, I'm very disappointed William Lantigua didn't go the distance on the recount. I thought he was going to go all the way to court. I had no idea that he was going to give up this
margin easily,
but a real disappointment for me and for all the Lantiguans who were in City Hall.
And Dante, one more quick Lawrence question before we move on, because I'm interested in your take that with it being smaller, there is some more ability to get things done. What do you think is the biggest challenge for Rivera? What's going to be the hardest to change?
One of the things that is striking or has been striking about Lawrence is that it's a city that has been in so much trouble for so long that there's almost there's been this history between the Latino community and the older term residents, primarily white residents who had been there for a longer time. You know, there's almost in those situations, there's this horrible sense of negativity and this can't-do attitude that develops when people feel like they're fighting over scraps and are doing so for decades at a time. And reversing that sense of, you know, inevitable decline and making people think that there is a better option out there, I think, is probably the biggest challenge. It also seems like it's the thing that Rivera is most targeted at. And for the reasons that John described, there are certain things that are outside of his control. So why not focus on some of the 30,000-foot atmospheric issues?
Exactly. Question about the Affordable Care Act as it relates to Massachusetts. The same technology company that designed healthcare.gov, which we all know has had terrible problems and continues to, that company designed the Massachusetts Health Connector site, which really has been a model site for many years, but is now having a lot of problems as people have to re-enroll and as the site is redesigned and relaunched as a result of the Affordable Care Act. Now, Dante, we've heard from many people here in Massachusetts that they're confused about the new site and they're having a lot of problems. Do you have any insight into whether Massachusetts officials are working as quickly as they can to resolve problems and get that to be somewhat of the model site it used to be? Dante, did we lose you? I think we've lost Dante. We have him on an ISDN line, a connector from the Globe, so we will try to get him back. But let me turn to John Carroll. What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, there's a German word, Schlimmbesserung, which means to make worse by trying to improve. And that's exactly what's going on here. The Massachusetts system was working just fine until it hooked up with the Obamacare system, which seems to be contagious because all the problems and more that people have been having with healthcare.gov, which is the federal website, people are starting to have here. One of the really strange things is that it puts all these people in jail. It keeps telling people that they're incarcerated.
Or their children are incarcerated.
Right, and so they're not eligible for the health insurance. So I think that this is the kind of hiccup that is only accelerating the sort of bad news, bad press for the Affordable Care Act.
Your Schlimmbesserung line reminds me of two others. One is that the perfect is the enemy of the good. That
right.
seems to tie in here. And of course, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It seems like that's also at play.
Right. And I think that a lot of people would have wished that it went the other way around, that Obamacare basically got folded into the connector, the health connector, rather than the other way around.
I think we have you back, Dante. You're there?
I am.
All right, good. You're back just in time for our hubbubs, which I know both of you have done. Those little stories that sort of fell through the cracks or at least didn't make big headlines, but that we've kept tabs on. So, Dante, what's your hubbub this week?
Well, my hubbub looks back 71 years to the Coconut Grove nightclub fire, which killed nearly 500 people on November 28, 1942. It's a famous, horrible incident in the history of nightlife in Boston. It led to major changes in bird treatments and fire codes, but it's surprisingly under-memorialized. There's no statue. There's a couple of plaques near the site. Thanks to the efforts of some diehard local history buffs, that's changing. Tomorrow, a road on the site will be renamed from Shawmut Street Extension to Coconut Grove Lane. And it's not quite a statue, but at least it suggests that this bit of Boston history will show up on Google Maps.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, a tragedy that really, I think, does deserve people to remember, even as the people who lived through it are no longer with us. So that's good to hear that's happening. John Carroll, your hubbub?
So it's not really Week in Review without Whitey Bulger, is it? So I thought, Here's a few fun facts to know and tell about the Brooklyn lockup where Whitey is currently residing. These are all compliments or courtesy of NBC News.
And we should note here, he was recently taken from Plymouth. He's
right.
headed to some final resting
Who
place,
knows
but
where?
The interim is Brooklyn.
Resting place. You're putting him in the ground a little early, Sasha. But anyway, he's at the Brooklyn Metropolitan Detention Center, which is co-ed. A federal judge has called for an investigation there because an accused cop killer fathered a child with one of the guards there. And there was recently a probe called Operation Badfellas, which uncovered what NBC News called a breathtaking pattern of corruption at the jail, including bribes to correction officers to bring organized crime prisoners, Italian heroes, meatballs, and cheese. So this is a place where I think Whitey's going to fit right in.
All right. I have a hubbub that I'm going to just say, I'm going to call it a public service, which is that there is some man from Providence, Rhode Island, who calls himself Redhead Flute. He puts himself in this gigantic, sort of larger-than-life-size snowman costume that he calls Freaky the Scary Snowman. And it looks there and kind of looks very kind and kindly, but then as people walk by, he basically scares them. I mean, he jumps or he moves or he whispers things. And there is a YouTube video circulating, in which is basically a series of people just getting terrified by the snowman, this sort of series of screams. And really actually quite funny after a while because, of course, a lot of humor can be about repetition. But we want to basically, the public service is to warn our listeners that if you see a big, benign-looking, scary, well, snowman, know that this might be a snowman out there to scare you, but it's really just this guy from Rhode Island, Redhead Flute, who, from what I can gather, part of his job might be creating YouTube videos, and this is a little bit of fodder for that.
This is what happens when you start doing Christmas before Halloween.
Exactly.
They get all mixed up and mashed up together.
Exactly. Thanks so much to our Week in Review panelists this week, Dante Ramos, Deputy Editorial Page Editor for the Boston Globe. Dante, thank you.
Thank you.
And also John Carroll, a professor of communication at Boston University, and he also writes the Campaign Outsider blog. John, thanks to you, too.
Thanks, Sasha. Sorry.
Stay with us. We'll learn how UMass researchers are taking clues from nature, specifically the gecko, to develop a super adhesive that can hold up to 700 pounds. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.